We're going to go on to case number 013831, David Jones versus Insecure Corporation. And Mr. Abel, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court. I represent David and Susan Jones. Mrs. Jones is with me here in the courtroom today. They're asking the Court to reverse the denial of a preliminary injunction because the District Court erred in holding that the Indiana Securities Act did not apply to a transaction by which Indiana residents were induced to trade their stock in an Indiana company for securities in another company. I'd like to address first, to the extent the Court has any questions on the issue that the Court requested additional briefing on, the jurisdictional geographic issue. Next, the scope of the choice of law clause. Following that, the securities law, the choice of law analysis does not apply, but rather that it's a statutory construction analysis. Then I would address the analysis for the common law fraud claim, and finally, that the transfer order should be vacated and remanded.
Right. I did want to pursue a little bit about the issues on which we had asked for more briefing. I realized that this had somewhat been briefed in the original papers, but looking at the documents, we have a couple of separate things. We've got the preliminary injunction.
Yes.
That was entered by the District Court, and it looks to me like, you know, it's a usual interlocutory appeal of a denial of a preliminary injunction. And so with respect to that, I guess I'm mostly interested in what you think a preliminary injunction would look like at this point. What are you really asking for? Because your brief hardly mentions the words preliminary injunction. Your brief is all about choice of law, so it almost seemed to me like it was a hook to get other issues up. With respect to the transfer, it looks to me as though, you know, as though the Northern District of Georgia served as a Kinko's function. You know, they sent the record back here, it was photocopied, it was then returned to Georgia. This case seems to be proceeding in Georgia, and I don't see how we could possibly have jurisdiction over a 1404A transfer order, normally not appealable. There's no request for mandamus in front of us. There is no consequence to the choice of law issue, as you probably know, from the 1964 decision of the Supreme Court in Van Dusen against Barrett. The Georgia court will have to apply Indiana choice of law rules. So every argument you're making, in other words, the Claxton rule doesn't apply. The Northern District of Georgia isn't going to look to Georgia conflict of laws rules. It'll look to Indiana rules. So it seems to me the only thing we have before us is the preliminary injunction. And as to that, it's not clear to me how what you want.
Well, there are a number of things we requested in the district court. Those issues are not briefed in part because the district court did not reach remedial issues and decided on the choice of law issue.
But why did the district court abuse its decision? I mean, there's a regular old test for how to grant a preliminary injunction, which your opponents discussed. What's wrong with what the district court did?
What's wrong with what the district court did was it decided that there was no claim under the Indiana Securities Act where there plainly is a claim, and therefore it exercised no discretion with respect to any of the other traditional factors. As this court has observed, a failure to exercise discretion is itself an abuse, as is a clear error of law, which we have here. In terms of the relief that we sought below, we sought that particular employees not be discharged, that support fees not be changed and increased, that funds coming from customers of the prison product not be diverted to other products.
But haven't most of the injurious acts that the Jones complain about, haven't they already occurred?
They have not all already occurred, Your Honor. Certainly a new motion on correct principles of law would involve determining just exactly where the facts have moved since the August hearing last year. But for example, one of the things that we believed was imminent, the HIPAA requirements, the government has postponed for a year. Those will be imminent again shortly. And that's one of the things we'd ask that the court do, which is permit or require InfoCure to allow the programmer that had been hired by our clients initially to do the programming necessary to serve customers in meeting those requirements when they go into effect. In terms of the jurisdiction of the 1404A issue, we believe it's pendant to the preliminary injunction issue. Your Honor, I think you have the benefit of me in terms of where the original documents are right now. We filed a motion requesting that the originals not be sent back to Georgia, and I didn't see anything on the Georgia docket indicating that they were in fact received back by the Georgia court. I saw that the Indiana court's intention
was to return them
to Georgia.
The other thing I saw was on the docket sheet, the original pleadings are transferred. There's an entry marked November 5th, 2001, and then their entry, this particular docket sheet, ends with an entry of 12/31/01, a bunch of stuff about counsel getting certified pro hac vitae and so forth. The record received, and the entry on 11/13 says, record received, the record will be photocopied and returned when complete. But then the Georgia court keeps on doing things, admittedly fairly ministerial things, but it's still acting, and these venue transfers could be viewed, I suppose, as simply following the file. They could be viewed as something broader than that, where the file is distinct. But I'm troubled with the flat fact that there had never been a preliminary injunction. This would not be a reviewable order. You could perhaps ask for mandamus. Sometimes courts of appeals grant writs of mandamus with respect to 1404A transfers, so it's a very high threshold. It's an interlocutory order, and I don't see why the preliminary injunction changes that at all, especially in light of the fact that the choice of law inquiry, by very deliberate decision of the Supreme Court, isn't affected by a 1404A transfer.
Well, it's affected to the extent that the district court's ruling on that issue, applying Indiana conflict principles, is going to be viewed as law of the case. And the court in the Colt versus Christensen case has talked about transferee courts should be very wary of overturning transferor court decisions. To that extent, it's relevant. But also, and I can tell you, had there been no preliminary injunction motion and denial of a preliminary injunction, in all likelihood there would not be an appeal. We believe it's pendant because it turned upon the same issue. The trial court transferred this action because it held that Indiana law didn't apply to any of the claims. We think that's wrong as to everything except the contract claim, and we think it's fairly clearly wrong as well. And so that is in essence why we've appealed and why we have sought review of the transfer order under pendant jurisdiction. There's also a reason why there is an amended notice of appeal in this case. At the time the file was transferred to Georgia and before it came back, we had to decide to file our notice of appeal. The notice of appeal at that time did not include the transfer order because of the whole file transfer rule jurisdictional issue. The one thing I would add, I think the parties are both saying the same thing on that point, on the geographic jurisdictional issue. One, that there's plainly jurisdiction over the preliminary injunction, and two, that a return of the file unwinds the transfer. That appears at page 6 of the appellee's brief. So we believe...
This may be a more complicated case than that, I suppose. That doesn't seem to have been the intent of the Georgia court. But... be that as it may, pendant appellate jurisdiction is a dicey area anyway. It's something the Supreme Court has sometimes appeared to recognize, sometimes appeared to discourage. Most of the versions of what used to be called pendant and ancillary jurisdiction are within the discretion of the district court, and I'm very worried about a situation in which an unreviewable transfer order becomes reviewable just because somebody has the presence of mind to get a preliminary injunction denied before they ask for transfer.
Well, I think the implication of your question is that the preliminary injunction motion is some sort of vehicle. The preliminary injunction motion was filed before the transfer motion was ever filed. It was always our intent to seek a preliminary injunction. I would also point out that this court recently in Greenwell versus Astar, 268 F3rd 486, which was an admiralty case, indicated that it's no longer so skittish about pendant jurisdiction because the Supreme Court's applied it a couple of times recently, including in the Clinton versus Jones case. But in any event, the preliminary injunction was not used as a vehicle to secure review of the transfer order.
You may not have, but I'm worried that if we sanction this procedural move, others who follow in your footsteps may think, I mean, there are a lot of cases where a preliminary injunction might be an attractive avenue, and if you're worried about a potential transfer, which it seems to me you might, I don't know whether you're worried about it or not, but this is an Atlanta company, that's where the contract was signed, and there were a lot of Northern District of Georgia connections. Part of the problem is you're making law for cases beyond yours, even if you were in absolute good faith asking for this particular preliminary injunction.
I think the limiting factor on that is whether, and it's the scope of the pendant appellate jurisdiction doctrine, you have to have a transfer order that is truly pendant to the denial of a preliminary injunction. Here they turn on the same issue. They're the sort of thing, as this court said in Patterson versus Porch, that are the head and the tail of the same coin. One instance where a court of appeals has reviewed or indicated it would review as pendant a transfer order is the Midwest Motor Express case, an Eighth Circuit case, which is cited in our brief as well. And I think there are limits to that doctrine. And certainly we're not asking the court to expand pendant appellate jurisdiction for precisely those reasons. The court has on various occasions said, well, if the preliminary injunction is just pro forma, we're not going to see something as pendent to that appeal, and so forth. We're not asking the court to change any of that law. We're simply asking the court to apply the law that currently exists with respect to both pendant jurisdiction and geographic jurisdiction, which the courts all seem to agree follows the file. And that's a rule that's perhaps a holdover from an earlier day when there weren't photocopiers, but it does have the virtue of simplicity and clarity, which is a good thing for jurisdictional rules. So the instances where you're going to have review of a transfer order other than by mandamus are relatively few and far between. With respect to the other issues in the case, the choice of law issue, we think the primary thing to look at is the scope of the choice of law clause. It simply says that it governs the contract. It does not say that it governs ancillary matters arising out of the contract. It's different in that respect than the clause this court looked at in Bonney. It's different in that respect, or it's actually similar in that respect to a clause that the Indiana appellate court found didn't cover tort disputes in the GM case. With respect to the securities laws and the issue turning on a question of securities law, again, the Lenz case and the Sims case, as well as all of the scholarly articles, we believe show very clearly that the Indiana Securities Act applies. And I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Engel. Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, in addition to answering the panel's questions, we'd like to make 3 points here today. One, that this case is governed by Indiana law, and that the Seventh Circuit's decision in the Wright-Moore case applying Indiana law should not be overruled to allow the appellants in this case to disavow their choice of law provision and apply the Indiana Securities Act. Two, the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction request should be affirmed in any event under the right for any reason doctrine, because the appellant so clearly waived their right to seek rescission by waiting to seek rescissory relief for over a year. And in any event, the appellants cannot show any irreparable harm. So for under the right for any reason doctrine, the denial of preliminary injunction should be affirmed. And then finally, I'd like to address the issue about whether there is pendant appellate jurisdiction over the transfer order.
Mr. Smith, can I ask you something? This isn't really a point that anybody much has raised, but it does seem to me that the only reason the district court gets rid of the securities claim is because it understands this is a claim specifically pleaded under Indiana law. It says there is, no such claim. It's going to be a Georgia law point. And then it goes ahead and handles the transfer because of that. But I'm worried about 12b-6. I mean, we don't plead law. You know, and I'm sure you've seen a million cases where somebody says, just because you invoked the wrong law in a complaint, that's essentially surplusage. We have notice pleading.
Mm-hmm.
The point here that these people are making is that InfoCure allegedly misrepresented its financial position and other material facts, and under some law, you know, maybe Indiana securities law, for all I know, under Georgia securities law, under common law of one or the other state, there should be a claim. So I'm kind of concerned about the district court's zeroing in the way it did on what essentially isn't a very important part of the complaint.
Well, I think that the, if I understand the court, it is an important part of the complaint that they chose to plead a securities fraud case under the Indiana Securities Act.
But why should this be an exception to the rule that we don't plead law in federal court? Rule 8 requires a short plain statement of the claim, showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. That's notice pleading. You know, we're letting you know that something
right.
wrong happened here. And then later on, you know, it's summary judgment. There's a time, of course, when the exact legal theory certainly does have to be fleshed out. And if underneath all of this there's a mistake of law, then on the preliminary injunction, which I think we all agree is properly before this court, can we be confident the district court exercised its jurisdiction properly?
I think so, Your Honor, and I think I would say this. I don't know that it was incumbent upon the district court to go and blue pencil the complaint and say, well, Indiana Securities Act does not apply. These people they agreed to the application of Georgia law in their complaint, yet they seek to disavow that and bring this claim under the Indiana Securities Act. The court said that's not going to apply. I don't think it's incumbent upon the court to go out and determine what other causes of action, what other similar causes of action could be brought. And I would also point out that they are free to go back and plead, amend their complaint, and try to plead any other applicable law, such as the Georgia Securities Act. That's, I think, the remedy for correcting the problem that you've raised, if I understand it correctly.
But, you know, the Joneses point out that the choice of law provision merely says that the agreement will be governed by Georgia law. It doesn't say that any and all disputes arising out of or relating to the contract will be governed by Georgia law. Doesn't that suggest that the application of the provision is limited to contract claims as, you know, for example, as opposed to securities claims?
Right. Let me respond in two ways, Your Honor. First, I'll quibble with their characterization of the choice of law provision as being that narrow first. It also says all rights and remedies to be governed by such law. So we submit that it is not simply narrowed to just a contract claim. It says all rights and remedies, which we would submit includes any and all claims that they bring. But secondly, even if you concede that point, even were we to agree, it's only applicable to the contract. Under Indiana law, as interpreted by Wright Moore, the Seventh Circuit's decision, as interpreted by the Barrow case, which is an Indiana Court of Appeals decision, Indiana follows the restatement. In the restatement says, under Section 201, that even if there is a claim for fraud or misrepresentation connected with the contract, you're still going to give deference to the party's choice of law, even if it's so limited to the contract. So under either alternative, it was still a correct application of Indiana law to kick out the Indiana Securities Act.
And your opponents argue that your reliance on the right for any reason idea that you mentioned just now, it's the kind of thing that it would be premature for us to reach because the district court, you know, had this very one narrow reason. Those are classically the things that district courts weigh in the first instance. What's your thought on that?
Well, we're not asking the appellate court to get in there and try to sift through a mound of undisputed fact. We're not asking the appellate court to apply sliding scales and balancing of hardships. We're really pointing to what are legal questions that you are perfectly able to handle on a de novo review. The first one is the waiver point. It is undisputed in the record that the plaintiff's appellants found out within a couple of days of the closing that they had allegedly been misrepresented to. Okay? Then a couple of months after the closing, the InfoCure's fourth quarter numbers come out, and they are lower, significantly lower than what the plaintiffs said were represented to them. Still no action. Months later, they are told that they're going to close down the Lebanon, Indiana office. They're going to no longer support and upgrade the particular software product. Still no action. It was over 16 months after first learning that there was some kind of fraud that the plaintiff appellants brought this suit. And it was even six more weeks before they chose to file a motion for a preliminary injunction. Now, it was interesting, at the hearing, the owner of the business was asked specifically, why did you delay after learning this? And the answer was something along the lines of, well, we decided to just kind of see if it would work itself out. Well, it's very clear that under Indiana law, even if the Securities Act applied, you cannot wait and see once you discover the fraud. The law requires anybody seeking rescissory relief to take immediate action to unwind the contract. So for that reason, it's our contention that there's clearly been a waiver of the right to seek rescission. Now, I will add to that that they can't even make an effective tender. It came out at the hearing that they had sold half of their InfoCure stock, so they can't even restore to InfoCure what it was they received.
But their response to that is that for publicly traded stock, if they just went out in the market and bought the same number of InfoCure shares, they could tender back. I mean, I take it the whole problem in this case is the price of InfoCure shares sank dramatically after the day of this transaction, so the number of shares they got was vastly, in a sense, less than the value would have been had it already gone down to the low point it hit.
That is correct, but I think it just shows, and in the meantime, InfoCure has split into two companies as well, so the inordinate delay makes it highly impractical to invoke rescissory relief, and we maintain that they have waived that. We think there's also been no showing before the court, the district court, of irreparable injury. The reason that there was injunctive relief sought was because of this supposedly impending exodus of customers. Well, they had a customer base of some 360 customers. The year when they owned the company, they had lost 7 or 8 per year. The year after InfoCure took control, they'd lost 10. There just really wasn't any significant change there. And at the hearing, all they were able to do is get affidavits or testimony from 6 people who said they were thinking about maybe changing.
Yeah, but a lot would also depend on who the customers were. I mean, if one customer is, let us say, Sears and Roebuck, and I'm the other customer, well, I'm not so sure that the numbers tell us.
There was no showing of a of particularly large customers. The way this business works, it's basically ophthalmology practices.
Oh, I know.
And there was no showing that there was some mega practice that was among the ones fixing to leave. So we think for that reason as well, it was appropriate for the district court to deny the injunction. There was a case last year, the Anderson versus USS Logistics case from the Seventh Circuit, which on the right for any reason doctrine, getting back to your earlier question, Your Honor, went to the factor of irreparable harm, even though that had not been addressed in the district court's opinion. So the district court chose to, had a number of ways he could have denied this injunction. He chose to go the route of Indiana law, we submit correctly, but could have reached the same result on any of these other factors as well. I guess I would close on this quick point about the transfer order and whether or not there's pendant appellate jurisdiction over that. We think clearly not. The issues are not the same. The district court transferred, they're not inextricably entwined. The district court made the transfer order decision based on a number of factors.
But relying heavily on this choice of law factor, it seems to me the only other significant factor the district court raised in its order about transfer was the fact that there are these other related cases pending in the Northern District of Georgia.
That is exactly right. But it wasn't the choice of law factor on the Indiana Securities Act. I mean, that was dismissed. It was the choice of law on the fraud claim and on the breach of contract claim, which are not connected with his decision and the decision that you can review, which is the denial of the preliminary injunction. So those issues, even if you reversed the court on the Indiana Securities Act claim, it would not follow that the case would still not be transferred to Georgia because it was done on the other grounds, including the fact that there are these six other cases and that there you have a judge down there who had been making discovery rulings and other rulings, and just to minimize the risk of inconsistent adjudications and duplicative rulings on discovery matters.
Can I ask you how you envision, suppose, contrary to I'm sure what you were hoping for, suppose we decided to reverse on the preliminary injunction and we said you were wrong, there really is an Indiana securities claim, and so we send it back to the district court for the Southern District of Indiana, which of course is the court over which we exercise jurisdiction. Meantime, the case somehow is off in the Northern District of Georgia. Does that mean that this little side end of the case travels on down to Georgia, or what happens there?
Your Honor, we would submit, and I'll have to confess to you that I'm in the same position as appellant's counsel. I was under the impression that the file had been kicked back to Indiana in toto, and that there was really no, and I think the record does reflect, there's no proceedings of consequence going on in Georgia. But yes, I would submit that if that were to happen, that it would have to go back to Indiana for the Indiana court. If it's just purely on the Indiana Securities Act issue, well, then he'll have to go back and pick up, was there entitlement to injunctive relief, rescissionary relief in any event, and we would submit at that point in time he is just going to deny it because of the waiver, because of the no irreparable harm, and we'll get right back up here.
Okay, wondering.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I suppose one point we should address on the other reasons for the district court's transfer. It's my understanding, and perhaps counsel for InfoCure can confirm, that the other cases down in Georgia have been settled. But in terms of responding to some of the points that counsel made, with respect to Wright Moore, we're not asking the court to overrule it. As the court may be aware, Wright Moore held that a choice of law clause in that case was ineffective. The court went on to say some additional things. We're asking the court not to extend that dictum, in part because it didn't consider the special securities issues that are involved in this case, and also in part because it didn't consider restatement of conflicts of law section 6, which says that a court will apply the statutory law of its jurisdiction without regard to conflicts of law. that's the piece that's missing. Certainly, it's a question involving the policy of the Indiana Securities Act and how choice of law plays into that. That's one of the reasons we asked the court to certify the question to the Indiana Supreme Court, and we believe that remains appropriate.
Can you deal with the waiver and the irreparable harm argument?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We've dealt with that to some extent in our brief. Under Indiana law, waiver is a question of fact. It requires a showing of prejudice. The evidence was disputed on that at trial, and while opposing counsel is correct that the district court could have grounded its order on a variety of theories, perhaps the district court believed, in light of the evidence, that it really couldn't resolve the issues in InfoCure's favor. I believe there's a reason the district court ruled for the reasons it did. In addition, this court has said in Aurora Bank Shares and other cases, that's simply not the thing the court's equipped to do. And while opposing counsel suggests that they're asking you to look at pure questions of law, I was just going down their table of contents, and indeed they're asking you to indicate whether we've established irreparable harm, where the balance of harms lays, et cetera. Those are simply not the things that are appropriate for a court of appeals to do, as this court has held time and again. Rather, those are things for the district court to do in the first instance. And for those reasons, we ask that the court vacate and remand the preliminary injunction ruling, as well as the transfer order. And I might add, we're only asking that you vacate and remand so that the district court has an opportunity to consider that order in light of the correct applicable law. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Abel, Mr. Smith. We will take the case under advisement.